From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Florida voters overwhelmingly supported expanding the state's medical marijuana laws last November when more than 70% of voters said yes to Amendment 2. But lawmakers are pushing major changes as it now becomes a law. Today, we'll speak with one of the authors of Amendment 2 about those changes, and we'll speak to a political scientist about how and why amendments change as they make their way from the ballot box to the law books. Plus, we've seen some big changes for Florida wildlife. Manatees are no longer endangered, panther kittens have been spotted north of the Caloosahatchee River, and the burrowing owl is now considered threatened by the state of Florida. We'll talk with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, the Western Everglades Audubon, and the Save the Manatees group about what's next for these three iconic Southwest Florida species. First, the news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Much of Southwest Florida's wildlife is protected at the state or federal level, be they endangered, threatened, or migratory birds, and their changing status with wildlife agencies could have big impacts on their habitat, survival, and sheer numbers. Later in the show, we'll discuss the endangered panther, the newly listed threatened burrowing owl, and the precarious success of the manatee, which is now no longer considered endangered. Officially, at least. But first, 71% of Florida voters said yes to expanding the state's medical marijuana laws when they approved Amendment 2 last November. The language Floridians saw in the voting booth expands the kinds of illnesses doctors would be able to treat with medical marijuana, and it called on the State Department of Health to draft the final rules for Florida to implement a legal medical cannabis industry. But since then, versions of the law making their way through the House and the Senate have offered competing ways to implement Amendment 2. Some provisions in the bills go beyond what voters approved, and other efforts to implement Amendment 2 propose what's been called a restrictive expansion of medical marijuana. Joining us to discuss the details of implementing Amendment 2 in Florida's medical marijuana laws is Ben Polara, the campaign manager for the group Yes on 2 that supported the amendment. He's with Florida for Care, which advocates for an overhaul of Florida's marijuana policies. He's also one of the authors of Amendment 2. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining our show today is University of Central Florida political science professor Aubrey Jewett. He's here to talk us through some of the details of how and why amendments can be reshaped by lawmakers well after voter approval. Thanks for being here.
Great to be on today.
Do you have thoughts on the implementation of medical marijuana laws, and how do you want to see the laws changed? Give us a call and share at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we are at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Ben Pilar, I want to start with you with the Amendment 2 campaign. Voters approved Amendment 2 last November. It was a ballot initiative to expand the state's existing medical marijuana laws that were first established back in 2014. For people who might not remember, what did Amendment 2 set out?
Amendment 2 set out to basically allow doctors and patients to make healthcare decisions within the doctor's office, and specifically legalize the ability of doctors to recommend medical marijuana under the Florida Constitution, and for patients and caregivers to obtain and possess and use medical marijuana, and for the establishment of what's called medical marijuana treatment centers, which is the industry that the law sets up to serve safe, affordable access to the patients of Florida.
Is that kind of modeled after other states that have already done this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the point that we first wrote this, there had been about 24 states that had passed or had just passed medical marijuana laws, and so we were able to take from a lot of those different laws to find out what had worked and what didn't. You know, one big example is the doctor-patient relationship. It is a physician certification under the law. It's not a prescription or an order, because those two things are illegal under federal law, and other states have passed legislation, passed amendments that require physicians to prescribe or order marijuana, like the current Florida statute does. And those laws have been ineffective because doctors simply don't go out of their way to break the law, break federal law, and put their DEA license at risk to do this. So we took examples from many different states, but I think that's one of the biggest lessons we took.
Yeah, it's great to learn from others. So why did your group, Florida for Care, opt for a constitutional amendment instead of a bill in the legislature?
Well, we would have loved the bill in the legislature, but at the time that we filed the first constitutional amendment in 2014, bills had been filed for 5-6 years running for comprehensive medical marijuana laws in Florida, and none got so much as a hearing. In 2014, of course, the legislature passed what's known as the Charlotte's Web Law, which, you know, many thought was kind of a political reaction to what we were doing in terms of putting medical marijuana on the ballot. And that law, 2 years, 3 years later, even after it's been amended with the Right to Try Act, is still grossly ineffective. The Department of Health had a series of hearings around the state in February on the implementation of Amendment 2, but a lot of patients under the current law came in and had complaints about, you know, having to wait 90 days to get certified for medical marijuana, it being difficult to obtain product, delivery schedules being bad, pricing being through the roof. And so, you know, I think Amendment 2 passing with the percentage it did was a mandate on expanding medical marijuana broadly in the state, but also a mandate on the previous law and its ultimate ineffectiveness.
Yeah. So is that Aubrey Jewett with UCF? When you hear this, does it kind of sound like the normal path? You try with legislation, you try to do with bills, but then when it just isn't getting anywhere, do people go for a constitutional amendment like this with the voters having their say?
Yes, that's certainly one of the big reasons that citizen initiatives are filed. When people feel that the legislature is not being responsive, and particularly when they feel that the legislature is not being responsive on something that the public would want or that a strong majority of the public would want, then really that's a textbook case of why we have the initiative. It's so that you can go around a legislature that refuses to act.
So now we're sitting here and we had 71 or 72%, I don't remember the exact, I know it was over 70% of people said yes on Amendment 2. And when people think about the state constitution, they think a constitutional amendment, they think it's a sacred thing, it's kind of enshrined, one of the most important aspects of our laws. Then we're now hearing about lawmakers that are changing this amendment. Can you explain to me, Aubrey Jewett, how is that possible?
Well, it's possible because of the way government is set up in the United States. Everything you said about the state constitution is true. I mean, it is the fundamental law of the state, and except for if it ever conflicts with the U.S. Constitution or federal law, it is preeminent in Florida. However, it also is sort of a broad blueprint for governance. And so the state legislature, whenever we have a new initiative, whenever we have a new amendment, whether it's done by initiative or even done by the state legislature itself, there has to be implementing legislation. And then after the implementing legislation, then usually some department or agency is going to have to also go through a rulemaking process as well. So all the details have to be worked out. And so in one sense, what's happening with this medical marijuana issue, it's not all that much different than what we see in a lot of other cases where you have an initiative. But I think perhaps where it's a little bit different is that Republicans in the legislature, at least some, still perhaps are not too keen on medical marijuana. And so they are using their power to implement legislation to try to either curtail a little bit of what's in there or at least shape it to more of what they like, which would be a more restrictive version. So that's why you end up now in the Florida Senate with like five different bills, although on average the Senate being a little less restrictive, a little more expansive, a little more true, I think, to the initiative. And in the House, though, you have a competing version of implementation that would be much more strict.
Yeah. So Ben Pallaro with the Amendment 2 campaign, so what role did Amendment 2 leave up to lawmakers to implement? And then what was left in the hands of the Department of Health? It was written pretty specifically.
Well, most of the responsibility for setting up the medical marijuana system is left to the Department of Health under the amendment. The legislature, though, is given the authority to pass laws consistent with the amendment. And so if they pass implementing legislation, the department will naturally have to live by that. And I think, you know, they would like to, right? Just they're bureaucrats. They don't want to be in a position of writing laws. They would rather get legislative instruction. But to add to the professor's point here, you know, these laws have to be implemented, but they cannot and should not be implemented outside of the plain language of the amendment itself and outside of the spirit and intent of that language. And unfortunately, this legislature has a rich history of doing just that and thwarting the will of the people through their implementation of these things. And you're actually seeing it happen right now with the other amendment that was passed last year in the August election, the solar amendment. You know, the implementing proposals on the House side are creating new restrictions on solar when it was an amendment to open up solar. The Senate entered into a consent agreement with the Supreme Court, whatever that was, 2 years ago on the fact that the redistricting maps they drew were unconstitutional. They admitted they were unconstitutional. The legislature thwarted the will of the proponents on Amendment 1, the water and land amendment that was passed in 2014 with 75-76% of the vote. So unfortunately, this is a not uncommon practice in Tallahassee.
Yeah, and you said that with the Amendment 2 campaign that there are competing versions of the medical marijuana expansion that are going through the House and the Senate. The House one seems to have the more restrictive one. And then what's going through the Senate right now? Is there anything that is faithful to the text of Amendment 2?
Yeah, Senator Bradley introduced Senate Bill 406, and on Monday at the Health Policy Committee of the Senate, he significantly amended and passed out of committee that piece of legislation, which I think, you know, is not the legislation I would have written. I think there should be a broader access to medical marijuana. I think the ability to smoke medical marijuana should be included. I think there should be more licenses issued to growers and retailers. But by and large, I think Senator Bradley has done a pretty good job crafting legislation that is, you know, conservative like he is, like the body is, but also faithful to both the language of the Constitution and the will of the 71% of Floridians who voted for it.
We are talking about the implementation of medical marijuana laws, and would like to know what you think about all of these laws and how they need to be changed or not changed. Give us a call and share your thoughts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we are at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Ben Pallara, you mentioned a minute ago a little bit about other bills that are amendments that have been proposed as bills in the House. And we did a show on that solar amendment just last week. And at that time, we reached out and spoke with Representative Ray Rodriguez of Estero. And his name has come up again now in connection with House panel approved bill HB 1397. And that's the more restrictive one that we're seeing coming through the House. We asked him again if he wanted to do an interview about our topic today, and he declined to join us. But we do have audio of him before the House Health Quality Subcommittee explaining his decision to exclude smoking or vaping of marijuana. Let's have a listen.
The bill prohibits vaping medical marijuana except by terminally ill patients. It also prohibits smoking medical marijuana and marijuana edibles. I think the bill analysis does a really good job of laying out the reasons why we're not interested in allowing smoking in this state. In 1999, the Institute of Medicine published a study based on a comprehensive review of all existing scientific data and clinical studies pertaining to the medicinal value of marijuana. That was actually one of the first studies that came forth and said the cannabis plant does have qualities that provide medical value. However, that study pointed out that smoking was not the preferred method for ingesting. Marijuana smoke contains many of the same toxins as tobacco smoke, including those that cause cardiovascular disease. As you know, this state and this legislature, over the past two decades, has invested significant resources in encouraging people not to take up the habit of tobacco smoking, because of the health costs and the health dangers that are later borne by all of the taxpayers later. It would be contradictory to be on one hand working to discourage people from smoking and on the other hand encourage the smoking of marijuana, which produces all of the same potential health consequences. So that is the reason we excluded smoking.
So Ben Pallara, what do you think when you hear that?
I think that Representative Rodriguez's heart is probably in the right place, but unfortunately, you know, where he's put that legislatively is, I think, outside of the letter of the Constitution, which implicitly and explicitly allows, at the very least, the smoked form of marijuana, if not the smoking of marijuana. And I think it's outside of the boundaries of what people thought about when they were voting, what their intent was. I think if you ask the average voter what they thought medical marijuana was, what marijuana was, it's the plant, the raw plant material that you smoke. That's what the amendment contemplated marijuana being. I think that is what 9 out of 10, you know, Americans contemplate marijuana being when you bring up the term. And so what I think they're doing, you know, in the House is outside of the boundaries of what the voters thought they were voting on and what the Constitution says. But even beyond the smoking thing, you know, the House bill bans smoking, vaping, and eating marijuana. So I don't even know how you're supposed to consume marijuana under the House language. I mean, it's just a total, you know, a total usurping of the will of the people.
I think that leaves only absorbing it through your skin. I'm not really sure how else one would ingest.
Yeah, I was thinking of putting.
I'm thinking of this.
Or putting it into a. Putting it into a solution and injecting it or something.
I know, yeah, and that's nobody's favorite. So I wanted to ask Aubrey Jewett with UCF. There are many things that Amendment 2 stipulated, one of which is that medical marijuana be available in forms like aerosols and smokable leaf forms. Is it possible that a legislative implementation can really change something as directly opposite of the language that voters saw at the ballot box, which they approved?
Well, when I teach my students about lawmaking, I basically say whenever the legislature's in session, anything is possible. You never know what they might do. But then, you know, we do have a system of checks and balances. And to expand a little bit on what Ben was talking about earlier about courts getting involved, I think it's highly likely that we're going to have one or more court battles on the implementation legislation. You know, maybe not. You know, maybe the more faithful and expansive Senate bill will be the one that's eventually adopted, and maybe it will be acceptable to all or most parties. But I have a feeling that we're going to see at least some attempts to roll back the medical marijuana amendment or to make it more restrictive than, again, as Ben was saying, than the average person expected. And so I won't be surprised at all to see some lawsuits filed and to see the courts ultimately make that decision. And once again, this would be pretty much par for the course for an amendment. It doesn't always happen, but it frequently happens that there are court battles to decide it. I mean, it's happened on a number of things. It happened on the Pregnant Pig Amendment some years back. It certainly happened with fair districting, as we talked about a little bit earlier. And it's happened on numerous others. So ultimately, probably the courts are going to have to weigh in on how far the legislature can go in restricting what's in the plain text of the Constitution now.
And those kind of activities would happen after the legislative session and after they've adopted whatever they end up squeezing out.
Correct.
Of
yeah, I mean, basically the process sort of unfolds, you know, like that. You know, first the legislature has to act and actually pass implementing legislation, and at that point, or of course if they don't act, you know, then there could be a lawsuit as well, but assuming that they do pass something, that's usually when the lawsuits would be filed, or if not, then, you know, perhaps when the agency actually issues specific rules.
And the threat of lawsuits later on something like this, does that have any impact on lawmakers as they're kind of, you know, plowing forward with what their idea is of putting a law together for a voter-passed amendment?
Well, you would think it should, but unfortunately in Florida, it often does not. We've seen a number of stories coming out over the last few years about how much money the state of Florida has spent on legal counsel, and in many cases outside legal counsel, defending constitutionally questionable measures, even when they've been warned ahead of time and even when there's pretty clear evidence ahead of time that what they're doing is unconstitutional. So, yeah, theoretically, we would think in a more logical place that the threat of a lawsuit, particularly when it's almost certainly going to succeed, would stop them from wasting taxpayer money. But unfortunately, we've got a lot of evidence that it doesn't really seem to have too much impact. They're going to do what they're going to do, and it's pretty conservative over the last 20 years, quite frankly.
Yeah, and Ben, you sounded like you had a comment that you wanted to interject there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Senator Bradley has said in his public remarks, you know, guys, we got to do this right and respect the Constitution because we don't want the courts to write this for us. And I think that's the posture that the Senate largely is taking on this. Maybe owed to the fact that they've got the most recent history of being handed, you know, something they didn't like from the courts with respect to the fair districting. But on the House side, I mean, you've got just a week or two ago, Jamie Grant, a House member from the Tampa Bay area, talking about some Arizona-style immigration laws that he's proposing that are almost certainly unconstitutional. And his message to the Tampa Bay Times and to the people of Florida was, let the courts tell me they're unconstitutional. So, you know, I think there are some folks who do care about, you know, not having this decided by a judge and actually fulfilling their legislative role and responsibility. But there are just as many others who don't care and who just want to do what their ideology tells them to do and, you know, let the courts sort out where they violated the law.
Another major part of implementing Amendment 2 is laying out the rules for medical marijuana treatment centers, which are also known as MMTCs. I want to hear again from Estero Representative Ray Rodriguez about how this bill would implement MMTCs.
As we look at medical marijuana treatment centers, MMTCs, what this bill does is it allows the existing dispensing organizations under current law to become MMTCs. This bill also requires that MMTCs will be vertically integrated, and what that means is that each MMTC will grow, process, and dispense medical marijuana. The bill allows for MMTCs to be licensed as the patient population reaches certain thresholds. So as the patient population on the compassionate use registry grows, that will trigger the Department of Health to issue additional licenses for medical marijuana treatment centers. The bill requires MMTCs to use one bank for all of its business-related banking, and that's to address federal concerns regarding medical marijuana proceeds and finances. And the bill requires MMTCs to have their product tested by a marijuana testing lab that has been certified by the Department of Health.
So, Ben Pallara, does Rodriguez's bill, his plan on medical marijuana treatment centers, does that line up with what you laid out in Amendment 2?
No, absolutely not. But to a certain extent, it doesn't matter because his plan, first of all, I believe there should be more medical marijuana treatment centers in the state than just the 7 that have been licensed under the current law, which, speaking of lawsuits, you know, the state has now spent, I think, $1.2 million defending their decisions on the previous law and requested another $800,000 to do the same in this budget. But, you know, Under their law with respect to the doctor-patient relationship, there will never be 150,000 patients for new licenses to be issued. So kind of what they want to do with licenses is really neither here nor there because their law so effectively thwarts the primary purpose and spirit of the amendment and the public policy therein that, you know, the necessary industry to serve the, you know, beneficiaries of the amendment doesn't need to expand or really even exist for a large part.
So did you say there are 7 current medical marijuana treatment centers?
There are 7. There were, and by the way, the term, there are 7 dispensing organizations that were awarded licenses under the Charlotte's Web Law and the Right to Try Law. And they would become medical marijuana treatment centers, but I think it's important to understand that in both the House and the Senate language, we're not talking about, you know, a grow operation in a store. We're talking about big, vertically integrated businesses that grow, process, ship, and retail marijuana all under these licenses and can open unlimited retail facilities under a single MMTC license.
So it's kind of like setting up a bit of a monopoly?
The monopoly has been set up, and I think the question now is whether the state continues to sanction that monopoly or whether they expand the marketplace to allow new businesses to come in with new products that, you know, compete on quality and diversity and price with these existing businesses so that patients can actually have some choices and good product at a good price versus basically being subject to you know, an oligopoly of a handful of big marijuana growers.
So they're saying that there are 7 right now, but the language in this says that there have to be 150,000 people served by them before they will consider granting additional licenses. Is that correct?
Correct. And under the House proposal, those additional licenses, there are 5 of them, they are granted to people, to companies who applied under the previous law and came in either second or third place. So, you know, the House likes to talk about, you know, government not being in the business of picking winners and losers. In this case, they're literally just picking the losers. And making them the winners, apparently. But again, you know, with how restrictive their law is in all the other respects in terms of patient qualification, in terms of what a doctor is responsible for doing to issue a medical marijuana recommendation, there will never be 150,000 patients. You know, an effective medical marijuana law usually means right around 2% of the state population takes advantage of that law, and which for Florida would put us around, you know, a 500,000 potential patients once the law is fully formed and functional. But, you know, under this law, it's like, you know, in New Jersey or New York, there's never going to be more than, you know, 50, 100,000 patients, because it's just simply, it's going to simply be too difficult to get access. It's going to be too difficult to become a patient. It's going to be too difficult to find an ethical doctor to write a recommendation. Only the pill mill type docs will be writing these recommendations. And then the prices are going to be through the roof. I mean, if anything, this will create some new marijuana users, people who would never have used marijuana if not for it being legalized for medical purposes, but it's going to drive them right to the black market.
Yeah. So Representative Rodriguez has been quoted in other news outlets, including Sunshine State News, as crafting a bill that he says will tread the careful line between implementing medical marijuana in the state, but also abiding by the federal government's stance that marijuana is still listed as a Schedule I drug, which is defined as no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. So Aubrey Jewett, how careful does the state of Florida have to be with that federal law still out there?
Well, I think they do have to take that into account. Certainly across the country, the other 20-some states that have legalized either recreational or medical marijuana have all had to take that into account. And actually, even more importantly, the people that are actually in the day-to-day business, you know, really have to take into account what the federal government might do. And under Barack Obama, particularly over the last few years of the Obama administration, they basically took a more hands-off role, and with Donald Trump, quite frankly, we don't know what he's going to do. You know, on the one hand, he seems to have a little bit of a libertarian streak in him, and in many cases, he's been more Democratic than Republican over the last decade. On the other hand, he seems to be surrounded by a lot of conservative lawmakers who may want to, you know, get tough, crack down on states that are basically allowing medical marijuana or recreational. So, yeah, it does put the state in a little bit of a bind. But, you know, on the other hand, it's what Floridians passed into the Constitution, and they do have an obligation to follow through and implement it properly and legally.
We do have a call coming in from Karen in Naples. Karen, what would you like to add to the conversation?
I just wanted to comment that as a millennial, and that has seen many of my friends be affected, you know, by possibly being able to have a medical license, and then, you know, for a disease or not disease, but, you know, for you know, maybe having epilepsy or any kind of, you know, medical reason, I've seen them get, you know, jailed or, you know, anything like that, and have them really affected. And I think it's a disgrace that we are, you know, pushing for such a bill, and that a lot of people went out and got all these signatures. I personally went out and got them myself, and I think it's so upsetting to see that now they're turning this amendment that we passed into something else. And I didn't even know that the oil concentrates weren't going to be able to be smoked by anyone. I believe that you said unless they're pretty much like they have cancer or like a serious disease.
Mm-hmm. So that's why we're talking about it today, because the amendment was passed. And, you know, honestly, Ben Pallara, a lot of people that probably went out and got signatures, just like our caller did, are surprised that it's going through this to become the law that they had voted for.
And, you know, it's shocking. It's not too surprising, again, given the history of the state legislature on fulfilling, you know, the language and intent of constitutional amendments in recent history here. You know, part of it is, you know, these folks come up to Tallahassee for 60 days every year. And they operate in a bubble that, you know, that encompasses a half a square mile around the state capitol. And it's important that folks like the young woman who just called in, you know, call their state representatives, call their state senators, and let them know that they don't live in a bubble, that they live in a place where they're representing constituents that elected them, and that this was not, you know, this is not what we expected when we passed this amendment with 71% of the vote.
It's also interesting. It's also interesting from the point of view of a millennial who this may be her first political activism that she got involved in, and then hearing how things work out. I mean, it's just something that you're not going to follow unless you started kind of on the ground floor to see where it actually ends up. We have time for one more caller, and I wanted to get Jessica from Inglewood. And Jessica, what would you like to say?
I just had a comment and a question. My comment: I'm a registered nurse, and the human body is full of cannabinoid receptors, which means to me we should be receiving cannabinoids. So I'm pleased that we're moving in that direction. They say it's a Schedule One drug with no medical use, but the government has blocked medical research. And I think a lot of that has to do with historically resistant entities like DuPont with polyester, large oil corporations, pharmaceutical companies, who would prefer patent synthetic versions of drugs rather than the naturally occurring ones to be seen as, so I suffer from complex regional pain syndrome, and I understand all about the opiate industry, the detrimental effects, the tolerance, dependence, how, in my mind, cannabis, the benefits far outweighs the drawbacks. And then my question was, how, as a medical professional, do I find out more about becoming licensed, possibly open a dispensary, or get more involved in that aspect of this as amendments to move forward?
Okay, I guess that might be a question then for Ben. Do you know, is there like a resource for people?
Yeah, I mean, you can just sign up for the Florida for Care emails at florida4care.org. And we're trying to keep folks updated on what's going on with implementation, which, the implementation of this is what's going to ultimately impact your ability to participate or not in this business at some point.
Well, we'll definitely be keeping an eye on it, and we're going to have to leave it there for now because we've gone a little bit over. But I do want to thank our guest, Ben Pallaro with Amendment 2 and Florida for Care. Thank you for joining us, and also Aubrey Jewett, political science professor with UCF. Thanks so much for being part of the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, panthers have crossed the Caloosahatchee, manatees are no longer endangered, and burrowing owls are now recognized as threatened by the state of Florida. Up next, we'll look at each of these species for an in-depth analysis of status and reality.